railroad track. It makes me feel so doggone blue to listen to that old smokestack. Drivers are rolling on, leaving me here behind. Give me back them good old days and let me ramble down the line. That lonesome train, I love to hear the whistle blow. She's taking the sun and leaving the rain and making me want to go.
This is Dave Monk, Prairie Monk, WAFT Champaign 90.1 on your FM dial.
Dave on the board. This is Sunday, January the 21st, 2018, and this is the Prairie Monk Show, WEFT's weekly look at the environment, rails, trails, greenways, melting snow, drizzle, fog, and all the other sorts of stuff that we get this time of year in East Central Illinois.
A couple of extraneous things here. First of all, I have been looking for a clamp that clamps your cell phone so that you can tie it onto a tripod. So if you wanted to cover something for something more than 10 minutes, you can't really hold your camera still in your hand. So you need a tripod, and you need to be able to connect the camera some. So this is a little device, and it is very, very helpful. And so you have to look for it in the camera departments, not in the cell phone departments. One doesn't seem to note the other one. So just look around, and if the answer is no, you might look somewhere else. But it's the sort of thing that can fit into your pocket and is very handy. And it's part of the cell phone era. Second thing I want to comment on is The state decides after you have had license plates and you have a little sticker to go on. Eventually you get 10 stickers there, and that's enough. They all come off at once. So the state gives you a new license plate. But when you do that, the bolts that hold your license plate on have rusted like crazy. And I just wonder how many people in Illinois are having a time putting that plate on. They give you a little sticker, which is a T sticker, and that indicates that you have paid your license fee and you have your plates because you've got to get them on.
You'd think that they would just send you a tiny little scraper, a really sharp little knife, to just take off the entire stack of 10 that were already there and you start fresh.
And it's... So I've had friends and relatives out there helping to instate my new plates. And they'll accumulate another little battery of stickers on the top right-hand corner. Those two things. Well, we have to say farewell to the Pocket Prairie. The Pocket Prairie has been there for over 30 years. And the building to which it is a part has been leased, and we have to get out of there. So once again, I've had quite a bit of help from Rich Cahill, Al Fredericks, Billy Allenwell, and others to get out of there and provide parking space for the new tenants. It will be a restaurant and a local brewery, and we really do wish them well. We thank them for the years that we've had. Smile Politely has an article on, and the News Gazette also has an article on what will be the intent. The building has been empty for quite some time, and we've been glad to have a pocket prairie there. It's quite amazing. I went to the eye doctors, and I met up with Jay, and Jay called me over, and I had to ask where I had encountered him, and he said, "Oh, I was on the construction crew that was putting in sidewalks outside your place, and we had a tour of the Pocket Prairie," and I've never really forgotten that. And so we talked, and then I asked him what he was doing now, and he's working for Clifford Jacobs, which is an organization that makes blocks for vehicles. They do molten steel and pour blocks. And then we happen to have a warehouse that is where they used to sandblast off the glitches that were on the castings. So just meeting people and talking, find out what they do and why and how. And that has been a part of the Little Pocket Prairie. Let me give you some history. The Pocket Prairie had 2 30-foot signs there, very, very, very large signs. And University Avenue happens to be a federal highway, and using Lady Bird Johnson interests, that was grandfathered in for 10 years. Grandfathering means that if you've been up with a rule that has changed, the Congress has changed it, or some other body has changed it, then you get to have your old rule for 10 years, and then there's a change. So you don't come into it suddenly. You get time to change it. Well, these 2 30-foot signs went down to one, probably about a 12 by 12 at the end of the corridor. The resulting battle axe prairie was a weedy patch, and an awkward patch. It's like the battle axe means that the building that is attached to is like the axe, and the handle is where the awkward spot is. We figured that we could put our own weeds in there instead of having sort of urban weeds. And we asked Dr. Youngerman, who owns the territory, if we could do that, and the answer was yes. It would probably save him quite a bit in terms of having to mow it or deal with the weeds. We brought in some serviceberry trees, and the serviceberries like a huge shrub. They simulate the forest part of the prairie forest ecosystem without having roots enough that they can lift up a building. And they became the simulated forest of the prairie forest ecosystem. We put in understory herbs in that area so that before the canopy greens over in spring, we have understory herbs. There's a shrub lady there. The shrubs are dogwood and basically, I'm trying to think of it, it's a legume too, and it's not blue. I can't think of the name. It's a legume, and that's spice bush and others that are understory herbs. There are vines that crawl through the layers of the forest, and then there's the forest itself, which has an edge timber, where you can move out and you can realize that the animals that fossil in the prairie would come back to the forest like a big grove to nest, to be protected, to sometimes find berries and fruit, but they roam out into the prairie, which is rather wet and not really a good habitat for nesting. There was a nice little path through, put in by Boy Scouts, and there's a simulated moraine. You have to know that the landscape was morainic. Now, moraine means that there's a glacier, a continental glacier comes down to that point with that particular temperature and might remain there for 1,000 years, and it's gradually coming forth from places like the Laurentian Shield in Canada and dropping gravel. And then when the world warms, that glacier goes back and leaves a lump of gravel and till. If the world gets colder, then the glacier will move south. So there are people who are specialists who know the age of these moraines and know the content and where they came from and what till and rubble is in them. Some of them are more rich in soil or till than others. The last glaciation was the Wisconsin, and prior to that was the Illinoisan, not quite as rich in soil. So we have a little spot where you can imagine a moraine with different sorts of rocks, some of them sedimentary, some of them basaltic, very mixed and very rich. Still might be in the forested area or in the prairie area. Yeah, we just had it at the edge. In front of the glacier, there's always a wet spot where all the glacial waters are melting at a certain temperature where the glaciers settle down. And so we have a wetland, and then species like ironweed and others that like that particular spot. We also know that there are species that like the edge timber. They like to be near some shade. Most of the prairie plants are perennial, and they like a lot of sunlight. So you see a little prairie had about 50 plants, different species in there. It reduced to about 30 because the soil we have on that little battle axe shaped plot is landfill. It's brick bats and glass and all sorts of things that don't amount to good glacial soils. So some of the more elegant species that we had there have disappeared gradually. We also have urban rabbits and other creatures that like to eat our prairie. We don't have a fence around it in the sense of having each species blocked off with a wire cage. We just are living with the environment we have in downtown. We do have birds. We have cardinals that have two families a year. We have finches, goldfinches that seem to like the seed that we have. And it's amazing. We have sometimes Cooper hawks, which will take out a dove because the dove moves fairly slowly. And the Cooper's hawk can move fast. We have night jars that you can hear them coming down with their mouth open, and they're collecting insects as they dive down, and you can, ooh, and then they turn back up. We have Canada geese. We have a couple of that they mate for life. So They have a nest on the pedestal of the water tower, which is a little bit further north. But they come as a pair, and they sit on the buildings next door, and they talk to each other and go on, and off they fly to some other location. Then they come back with their family, and you don't get between them and their chickens, or you're in strife. They are big enough a bird that they can land on your back and flap their wings, and you're sorrier for it. So then there are also the more voluminous groups of Canada geese that come. You can see them flying around in a V-shaped corridor. You have one goose breaking the air, and then that will change. Somebody else will take the lead situation, and that's a way of moving through the air and sampling the thermals and finding ponds. It used to be that the Canada geese would go further south, but these days they're staying around. They're very annoying to some people, especially people who have ponds, because they are prone to droppings just everywhere. A little bit like the crows. Crows that were over there the other night. There were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of crows on our trees and in the prairie, but they were also lined up on the railroad station roof. Crows are pretty intelligent creatures. And they select a tree for the night, and that's it. And afterwards, you have a whole lot of guano. So we've talked about the city having to wash the pavement after the crows have used two trees as a rookery. So we have that too. And right now, there's a whole bunch of guano over on the little prairie. So there was a trail. Now you have come through the edge timber. There's a little area for people to meet and sit and enjoy. And that's been used over the years a lot. And people remember it. And the trail goes around and drops down. The area was terraced so that the 30-foot signs had an elegant base. And that provides an opportunity to plant prairie plants. Mostly we planted plants rather than seeds, because seeds take 5-10 years sometimes to grow. And we had and have right today the litter provided by the big blue stem, Indian grass, switchgrass, and cord grass. And you can look over the fence to a little plot that faces Chestnut Street, and there's a whole bunch of prairie. Right now it's in wintertime, and it looks like a dead site. Not too exciting for people who are used to horticultural flowers that have eventually been bred from the like of prairie plants, but the prairie plants flower for a short time, are smaller. They have interesting fruiting bodies, and the Baptisia there has its fruiting bodies. They're empty because insects know that this is a legume and this is a healthy food. And I haven't ever done a sampling of the insects, but we certainly do have a lot of insects, including pollinators and bumblebees. Bumblebees come and they have saddlebags. They stuff pollen into their saddlebags. They find nectar in the flowers like bee balm. And mint that is favored by pollinators. We have a lead plant and indicator plants that indicate a halfway season prairie. So even specialists enjoy this little prairie. It has allowed us to introduce people to the prairie that have not known what a prairie is. I came from Australia and I could not find the ecosystem, and I found it mostly along railroad beds and in vacant places like cemeteries that haven't been mown, and in corners of fields that, where you couldn't turn a team of horses. It's there, but it's 0.1%. It's 0.01% that's remaining, that is original prairie. So people are planting prairies, and so this also inspires people to plant them. If you can plant them on a landfill on next to Goose Lake Pond and have a prairie downtown, the Goose Lake Pond that doesn't exist anymore, but that's sort of where it was. And you can stand back and take a photograph of a lead plant that's 3 feet high and with the MTD building in the background. So there are people who specifically like to plant to photograph the prairie with the buildings in the background. They're sort of amazed that this is an odd spot in downtown Champaign, which actually gives the street some character. We do have people who use it alternatively. We have some people who drink beer or sleep there or roller skate on the building next door or even die there. So you have homeless people who like to use the site in summer when it's cool and the forest part of the prairie is shaded. But there are also pernicious people who do things like take the copper out of the commercial air conditioners behind the building, and that costs you $3,000 to replace the copper, for which they would probably get some $5 or $10. But without watching it all the time, there are dozens and hundreds of people who've come back. Children bring their parents bring their children. They sit there and read the paper, they read a book, they are just enjoy the site, which demonstrates its usefulness as a pocket prairie in a downtown. There are places like Chicago where they try to do this sort of purposefully. They don't put the buildings up to the street level. Like, there are buildings on University Avenue that have very little setback, and very little room for a tree or a space to think. And what space is left is right adjacent to University Avenue and all the traffic. So this is a quiet spot, and one that's enjoyed, sometimes violated. You have to have someone nearby who will be out there with a flashlight at 12 o'clock at night and give field trips so that at least the people who are there smoking a joint or something like that. But there's another reason for this little spot to be in, preserved. We have to deal with policemen who have take care of these sorts of things, and especially if there's people sleeping there. So there's a yin and a yang to this little prairie. We have it fairly well documented, but it will be sad to see it go. The area is being looked at by a lot of people. Can we have some development which would include a prairie plant or a little spot? Possibly not. But if you go to Smile Politely or the News Gazette, you can find some of the details, because the people are, I think, coming in from Peoria, and they are going to let people know what they're doing. So that'll be rather interesting. We have to thank Dr. Youngman profusely for letting us have the site for 30 years. We have to thank Tom Pansom and other managers for Dr. Youngman's Coons clothing store and other buildings, for they have been interested too and very helpful. And we've had parking on this end of it, so that's what we'll have to get out of now. Mm-hmm. Surprisingly, this week we had, or in the last week, we had a big class of architects. These are senior students, and I just happened to look out and see a bunch of probably 20 or so, 30 students, and asked them if they would like a field trip. I'm always doing that. And yes, and I think they were kind of amazed. They have to also think about gentrification and fitting little nooks and crannies in here and there that make a city interesting. So I took them on field trips. It was cold, it was icy, it was sloppy, it was snowy, but the plants were there in their winter array. And if you're a prairie nut, you can see the big blue stem dropping down like a bundle of Skittles. You can see the winter reaction. It's absolutely amazing. But for people who are not used to looking with that sort of curiosity, this looks like a weedy mess in winter. Most park districts take all their flowers out at the end of the season, so it's bare soil. This is not bare soil. This has got all those plants and some creatures, too, that are in that location. The piece that's when you walk around the piece that is owned by Dr. Youngman, there's a piece that's owned by the Pope family on the other side. And you can look over and see rosin weed and coreopsis and baptisia and little blue stem lined up in a line along a very formal planting. But it's a little blue stem is quite a diplomat. There's a big prairie dock there. It probably has it probably has a 10-foot root, and it shoots up its fruiting body at least 10 feet. And that's a problem because it has been it violates the dignity of the smaller volume advertising side on the side above the prairie. So we have to prune it, unfortunately. Sometimes it gets left where the sign has been removed now. So this year the prairie dock has been able to express itself. And actually, someone with a man lift has been able to harvest the seed from the top. Overall, interesting things happen. And we can even sometimes, some of our prairie plants, like cup plant, get to be a little on the weedy side. So you have to manage the prairie in a small plot. If it was out there as a 10,000 acres, it would mind its own business and be controlled by other creatures and animals. And but if you're in a small plot, you have to control it, and we have to reduce the amount of cup plant. It's kind of interesting because it has leaves that fuse and create a little cup, and the rain collects in the cup, and you could do 10 PhD theses on what goes on in the little cup, paramecium and all sorts of other creatures in there. So it's an interesting plant, but it also is a fairly aggressive plant. Tall coreopsis is fairly aggressive. So the ones that we have survived, about 30 species, are the strong elements of the prairie, or the ones that can survive in that habitat. We can even have some prairie smoke and a few other more sophisticated species if we can provide them with a habitat that's like unto the nature. You can go around once and be surprised. You can climb through a grapevine, a prairie grapevine, which is at the base is 3 inches across. It has grown large. It grows into the tree, and I purposely leave it there so that people can have to crawl through it and have to ask, "What is this thing?" Just recently, as in preparation for the future, it was taken out, so you can now walk very directly through that corridor without having to climb through the grapevine. But it was serving its purpose in its day. It actually has nice little grapes. They're very, very bitter. So you don't eat them very easily, but you could. You got to wonder a little bit if you're eating something from the pocket prairie, because the roots are into a landfill, and you don't exactly know what's in the landfill, but kind of fun. Some of it leans over the fence. Some of that causes problems. We had a nice lead plant right on the fence line, and it would poke its nose through the fence, and then it would get herbicided. So people who herbicide and clean up their side of the fence don't always realize that this has the herbicide is a systemic herbicide. So that herbicide goes right down into the roots. So we lost a very nice lead plant there. It's kind of interesting that it's found its photographic way onto a CD. The Mean Lids have it on their CD as a cover shot. And other groups have put bits and pieces of the pocket prairie on their CDs. You can see it in the morning. You can see it at noon. You can see it at sunset, and you can see it at night. So I give field trips with a flashlight, and you can see at least some of the prairie at night and get a feeling for it. There are things that there are nocturnal insects, for instance, at night that you don't see during the day. There are mice. There are rabbits. The urban territories have become our only natural areas, because once you go out of town, it's all corn and soybeans. So we really don't have any habitat for prairies left. What prairies are left are often in town. There's a Meadowbrook Prairie or the Weaver Prairie or Reconstruction Prairies. And they're very good. They not only look like a prairie and act like a prairie, they may not have 110 species in them, but they surely give creatures a feeling that they're at home. This is a prairie, and the people who plant those prairies often start off with a very simple prairie, with the grasses that grow and look good, and they wave their wooden leg in the wind, and you can see the wind riffle across them. So the grasses are often thought of as a prairie, but they're like 110 broadleaf species here. And we don't have them all, because Champaign County was a very flat county. And when you have a flat county, you don't have a lot of variety for habitat. If you were in the Ozarks, and you have to have wetland and nooks and crannies and shade and rocks, then you can have 400 species, because there's that variety. There's bare rocks that have lichens and mosses on them, little spots of water, little waterfalls here and there that are intermittently only there when it rains. Sometimes they're permanently. So this range of habitat we don't have in Champaign County. We have to go to Vermilion County, Piatt County, DeWitt County. These are all counties that have some terrain. And so we try to simulate that as best we can. We can't burn this prairie. It's in most land-based ecosystems need to be burned. Yeah. Early settlers came and they put they had a Smokey the Bear, and they taught people how to protect prairies and forests and other ecosystems from fire. And that's been a very wrong thing to do. What happens is that the litter that's usually burned by lightning strikes or sparks here and there, that usually results in a quick, gentle fire. You will have a clump of big blue stem, and you'll get red in the face if you're too near, and if you've got the camera, it'll melt your the chemicals that join your lenses together. So you have some heat, but it's very short time, and it goes. There's not often a lot of smoke with it either. That's probably if you do it at the right time of the year when there's not a lot of green material. Once you get green material, you're getting to have a problem with smoke. But we can't do that in that little pocket prairie, so we have to give it a haircut each year. And you don't have to do it every year, but there's a whole bunch of people that have to get to know what the plants are, because the plants do just look like weeds, and it's very easy to take down a piece of lead plant that might have been there for 30 years, not realizing that, no, we don't get rid of that sort of shrubby creature. It's there as part of the scenery, so people learn that way. We also have some invasive plants, and some of them are like morning glory that wind its way, and so we have people who have to unwind morning glory and take it away. There's also a vine that's a milkweed that can go everywhere. It will invite monarch butterflies and a whole bunch of other butterflies too, but it's a weed, and we try to control that. And we try to convince people who are just out there because this is ambiance that there's a little bit more than ambiance. The architects that came this week were numerous. They were here to use that as a theoretical spot for putting in a bookstore. And you have to wonder about that as an assignment, because bookstores have been losing out. We lost a big bookstore in Savoy just recently, and other bookstores have been having their problems, mainly because the internet is challenging. They can get a book for less on the internet, and there's always a question of, is the internet paying the taxes? And so we are in an era when we're trying to sort out who pays what for what. And you can indeed get your books for less on the internet, and that puts bookstores out of business. But bookstores have been changing to media centers, so I wonder what the outcome of this class. It must be a fairly large class with supervisors and lecturers who are in charge of small groups, because they've come through in groups. And you have to know that this little pocket prairie is on Market Street, and Market Street in its day has been a rather raunchy street. And it was part of the East Central Illinois Mafioso with a whole bunch of areas where there were bars and brothels and places of interest, perhaps a coffee shop in front, but starting price breading in behind. People would come to town and stay in places like this, or go on to Chicago and sometimes drink down their their earnings and come back. Some would leave their horses in a stable, and the harnesses would be repaired. So just up the road from us, there was a 33-story harness factory. The top floor burned, so it's now two stories. We don't know quite what will be in the future. Cofusion has bought that building from the News Gazette, and they've also bought the building that's adjacent to the Little Prairie. Just very nearby, there was an elevator. The railroad line came through on very close to us. It had a early station, so we have photographs of the early trains coming to town. You have a railroad plat, which is parallel to the railroad line. The railroaders were given land to put in the railroad, and they were able to sell the land and develop it. So Champaign became a commercial town. This railroad did not go through Urbana. We're not quite sure why. Sometimes people didn't want railroads to come through their town. All the steam and coal and whatever that goes with it. Sometimes it's the geological situation. So in early days, you had a place where called a Dome House, I think, that was on the east side, and that's where the engine drivers would stay and the railroaders. Then there was an old railroad station, a depot, and it served for quite some time, but in about 1923, that depot was rather cleverly for the era, put on rollers and skids and pulled up the corridor a little bit. So if you go to the Black Dog Saloon these days, that was the old railroad station. In its place, there was a 1923 fairly large railroad depot, three stories, and that was a headquarters for a lot of the railroad activities. The engineers were there. If you wanted to rent a piece of railroad line for agriculture, you had to go there to get your details. This was a little bit like relating to Chicago, where there are headquarters, or Memphis. Other places had regional headquarters, but and then what they did was they took the railroad line and changed it. Why did they change it? Well, in 1928, you had a lot of trains, but you also had a lot of cars. You had T-Model Fords running around, and you still had horses and buggies and whatever. And there were so many trains that it was getting to be a pain to go to University Avenue, and the university had been developed by this time. And find you had to wait for a long time for trains to pass. You having this day is happening. If you go to Philo, there are so many trains going past that you sometimes have to wait for a long time. It gets to be very frustrating. So what they did was they had a moraine at Paxton, which was the highest hill between southern Illinois and Chicago. And it was steep enough. Railroads don't go up hills, and they don't go around corners easily. So they go straight. So this was a fairly straight railroad. But when you came to Paxton, you had to have a pusher engine waiting by so that it would help to push the freight cars over the hill. So there were two railroad lines there, one going north-south, one going east-west, and the nickel plate going east-west. And it was decided to carve a way through that moraine. And where did the soil go? It all came to Champaign. And they created another railroad on the east side of the railroad depot. So the line that used to come by just adjacent to the little pocket prairie now was on the other side, and there were four tracks in some places. There were a lot of trains, and there were a lot of passengers, and this was the only way many people came to East Central Illinois. Some came up the rivers when they were at a peak flood and could handle flat-bottom boats or canoes and things like that, but many of them came with railroads. Some few of them came by canals, which were almost obsoleted before they got into action. They were obsoleted by rails. And they have continued to some extent in the Illinois River and Mississippi River, where they have perhaps 29 locks and dams that keep the water high enough for punts and barges to still operate. It has a lot of controversy to it because it takes out the nature of the river, takes out the waterfalls and the regime of an ecology that's dependent on wet sometimes and dry sometimes, and there's a whole bunch of netters that like to be in ripples and they hide under stones. They collect bacteria with nets, and it's rather wonderful. But the commercial side of things means that river has been channelized. That means you straighten out the curve, so you don't have big meanderers that take you a long while to get through. You have cutoffs, and those cutoffs run water fast. But if you have powerful paddle wheels and steamers that can negotiate that, they can get up the river faster than if they had to negotiate the meanders. And you have to know that the meanders cut in at one side, but they have beaches on the other side, and so it's very easy to have shoals and sandbars that where you can get stuck. So it wasn't easy to get it up the river or down the river. You had to know about flooding. You had to know that when the rainy season came, then you were going to have a very rapidly moving river. You could almost have a punt that was built to float down the river. You didn't really have to have a driving force to take it. You could go down to Memphis and New Orleans, and there you could just leave the punt and take a Natchez Trail or back up north and do the same thing again. And as you got power, and you could avoid that, and as you put in dams, you could avoid it. So some of our nature has gone in that direction. In East Central Illinois, we didn't have a river. We have the Sangamon, but we have watersheds. We have about five watersheds. We have the Kaskaskia, which runs out south of St. Louis. You have the Sangamon, which runs into the Illinois River at Beardstown. You have the Salt Fork, which goes into the Vermilion and goes out to the Wabash and to the Ohio. And north is some rivers that actually move north. This was very swampy area. It was flat and involved moraines, the Champlain Moraine, the Bloomington Moraine, the Urbana, Yankee Ridge Moraine, a whole bunch of things. And there was another river there that was the Ombra that took water south and also joined the Wabash. So thinking about these things, you can look at the little prairie and let your imagination go forth. And then if you get hooked, We'll take you out to a real railroad bed where there's preserved natural history and introduce you to a remnant prairie, the plants, where the plants are basically what used to be here. They might be invaded by Russian olives or autumn olives, what they're sometimes called, things like teasel that are a rather interesting dried arrangement for cemetery. So if you're near a cemetery, you bet your bottom dollar you're going to have a whole bunch of teasel. So then people get interested and they spend years trying to preserve the dignity of this environment. The architects started to look around at this. I found out that their last assignment had been the preparation of a nature center. So, and others were interested in low-income housing. And so I talked to some of these people, and this is very typical of just how we interact and how they get to know the street, how they get to know the butt out, and I don't know what you call it, but on the second floor of buildings like Seven Saints, there is a little alcove where you can actually sit and look up the river, up the street, and see what's going on. And that was kind of essential in the era of mafioso. You needed to know who was who and who was what and whether who was paid off. And you could probably have the cops come in one corner and the people go out the other corner, 8 or 10 buildings different. And they were all interconnected to some extent. By the 50s, this area became a center for rotogravure, preparation of the materials for newspapers and production. And the Grubb family was here. They came in about 1956 and occupied land on the Walnut side of the street, but also the Market Street side of the street, and the News Gazette was just up the road. And so you had linotype machines, clicky clack 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 clicky clack clack clack, and so you would set lead to represent your letter, whether it's A or a Z, and then you would have journeymen that would put those letters together, and you would have photographs made that were in lead also. So eventually you'd get a frame with your newspaper page up, and you couldn't send that out to everyone, say it was an advertisement. You had to then take a paper mache copy of it. So we had big presses where the paper mache copy was made, and if you were sending it off to Watsika or somewhere else for their paper, their advertising, they had a counterpart machine where they could pour lead into that that form and then print from it. More sophisticated was the fact that the Grubb family used to prepare graphic material for the medical industry. That meant that they had to have very good printing. They had to have depths of field. They had to, if they were printing in color, it had to be the pimple. It had to be the color of the pimple, and not just any old color. And so, and there had to be no glitches. So, you made your letterpress materials, but then you had journeymen that could come with a very tiny little needles and correct it where it should be corrected. So you had to have proofing presses. So we have one proofing press next door. It weighs 55,000 pounds. It has beams underneath it and on top because it's very, very heavy. One of them was taken out. There were a pair of these Rolls-Royce printing presses in the 1946. These were state-of-the-art. And they had to take out one of those little what do you call it, jutouts that you have on the Seven Saints, and put in put this press in on the second floor, two of them. So you had to have rollers that were very, very narrow, just perhaps an inch high, and you had to have a crane which lifted this very heavy press up and put it through that window with only a couple of inches to spare. So one of those presses was taken out. It had to be cut up into little pieces because to try and take the bed, which is about 10 feet long and about 10 inches deep, to take it down the stairwell, there would be no stairwell. It would fall down. So you had to take it in little pieces, two by two. But we saved one press, and we've used it for artwork. It can be used by artists. It was a very, very sophisticated press. You had to have that roller kissing the letterpress underneath it, or it might have been copper, and just had to kiss it just right. To do that, they had a Thermofax machine, which would give you a height difference so that you could tell where there were any glitches. And once again, you had journeymen that were mostly men that were able to make sure that this was a printing that was suitable for medical illustration. Later, that was converted to a rotogravure, and so that was a different industry. You didn't have the linotype anymore, and you did things photographically, and then later again there was a digital age. Oh, wow. So it rolls around quickly. So anyway, Market Street is in change. It's getting gentrified, and Weft will be a part of it, and so will areas next door and Heartland Pathways, and so will the sound studio on the Taylor Street, and the restaurant, which is Seven Saints to the south, and we'll have a new event, and so keep your eye on it, and we'll be back with more information. It's sad to lose the prairie. Some of you may want to help us extricate some of the plants. Some of them will have 10 and 12 feet roots, so they don't move easily, so we were wondering how we interlock with the new tenants. But
how long do people have when they can still go and visit it before?
We don't know for sure. It probably means, I don't think there's going to be too much development in cold weather.
So we'll maybe a couple of months even. Weeks for sure, though.
I'm not even sure about that. Oh. When you have a lease like that, then the leasees need to take over. So it might be immediate. We'll let you know what's going on. It's been a rather wonderful experience. But take a short look at the prairie before it goes, if you get a chance. Just take a walk around the corridor. Yeah, it's a little stairwell that's not so good in slippery snow, but otherwise you can enjoy it. This has been Dave Monk, the Prairie Monk, WEFT Champaign 90.1 on your FM dial.
And Dave on the board, and it is now noon. And let's see, the views and opinions expressed are solely those of the speakers and no one else. And since it is noon, that means it's time now for Shruti, Music of India.